Before we get rolling today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got this full Series 65 course that is just incredible.
Oh, yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's got adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams. And the best part is they're weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge, right? Because taking practice tests that actually feel like the real exam just changes the whole dynamic of your prep.
It totally takes the anxiety out of it. I mean, you can walk in on test day and just know what to expect. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
All right, welcome into the deep dive. We are super thrilled to have you with us today. So for this session, we're pulling from a massive stack of sources.
Yeah, we've got the statutory text of the Investment Company Act of 1940, SEC historical archives, and some really dense case studies on ETF arbitrage.
Plus the core Series 65 curriculum, obviously.
Yeah.
And we're basically taking all these super technical, kind of dry documents, and we are extracting the actual logic behind them.
Right, because our mission here isn't just to memorize definitions. I mean, if you just memorize the textbook definition of, say, an open-end fund, the exam writers are just going to tweak the wording slightly.
And you'll freeze. You'll just totally blank.
Exactly. So we need to understand the plumbing, right? Like, why were these rules written in the first place? How do these vehicles actually work in the real world?
Yeah, because you're staring down the barrel of this exam,
Yeah.
and pooled investments are a huge, highly testable chunk of it.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you understand the mechanics, they really can't trick you. And, I want to set the stage right now, because if you're someone who maybe finds standard finance lectures incredibly boring or hard to focus on,
Which is completely fair, by the way.
totally fair. But if you're pacing around your living room right now, or maybe you're out walking the dog, that is perfect. Just keep moving. We are going to keep the pace up today.
Yeah, we're bypassing the dry textbook stuff entirely. We'll be mapping out the exact traps those exam writers like to use.
Oh, they love their traps. We'll flag all of them. And we're going to break down these concepts using some really weird but tangible analogies.
And to do that effectively, we're going to use three client archetypes.
Right, because when you work in this industry, you realize pretty fast that regulatory rules don't just exist in a vacuum.
They don't. They exist because different investors have wildly different psychological needs, different risk profiles.
Exactly. So let's introduce our cast of characters and keep these folks in the back of your mind because we're going to use them to stress test every rule today.
Archetypes are actually amazing for memory retention.
They really are. Attach a dry rule to a human behavioral and boom, it sticks. So first up, we have Frantic Fiona.
Oh, Frantic Fiona. Every advisor has one.
Oh yeah. She is highly anxious. Her whole defining trait is a desperate need for instant liquidity. Like if she reads a scary headline on Twitter at 10:30 a.m., she wants her entire portfolio sold by 10.31.
She hates waiting. She
Yeah.
needs continuous pricing.
If she can't get her cash immediately, it's just pure panic.
Right. So for Fiona, the most important metric for any investment is its secondary market liquidity.
Exactly. Okay, next up, we have Passive Pete. And Pete is the complete polar opposite.
Pete is very skeptical of active management.
He is. He hates fees. He refuses to pay some Wall Street manager a single dime to try and guess which stocks are going to go up.
He represents that massive shift we've seen toward passive investing.
Yeah, Pete just wants to buy a fixed, predictable basket of stuff, go to sleep for 20 years, and wake up for retirement. Cost efficiency and structure are his whole deal.
And then, of course, we have billionaire Barry.
Ah, Barry. Barry operates in a totally different stratosphere.
He really does. Barry hates taxes. He loves highly exclusive, super high-risk deals.
He has yachts, plural. And most importantly, he has tens of millions of dollars in liquid capital to play with.
Right. Barry wants outsized returns, and he's willing to lock his money up for a decade, if that's what it takes to get them.
So Barry is going to be our key to unlocking the exemptions in the regulatory code later on.
Because in the private markets he plays in, the standard consumer protection rules just do not apply.
Okay, so we've got Fiona, Pete, and Barry. Let's take them into the absolute bedrock of this whole regulatory universe. I'm talking about the Investment Company Act of 1940, or, the ICA.
Right, and you really have to look at the historical context of 1940 to understand why this specific law is so strict.
We were just dragging ourselves out of the Great Depression.
Exactly. Back in the 1920s, before the crash, you had these massive investment pools that were completely unregulated.
Just a total Wild West.
It was. Wall Street insiders would launch a fund, take retail money from regular people, and then secretly use it to buy their own failing stocks to prop up the prices.
Wow.
Or they'd charge these exorbitant, completely hidden fees. It was a black box, and everyday investors got slaughtered.
Total asymmetry of information.
Precisely. So Congress stepped in and said, look, if you're going to pool money from the general public to invest in securities, you have to register as an investment company.
And you have to play by a very strict set of rules.
Very strict. Rules on transparency, leverage, and liquidity. So the ICA is basically the umbrella that protects frantic Fiona and passive Pete from being scammed.
And when you actually dig into the text of the ICA, the law categorizes investment companies into three statutory types. Which is funny, because one of them is practically a fossil.
Yeah, it's true. The three types are face amount certificate companies, management companies, and unit investment trusts.
Let's just address the dinosaur right away. Face amount certificates, you almost never see these anymore.
Very rarely. Historically, you'd pay a lump sum or maybe installments to a company, and they'd guarantee to pay you a fixed face amount at some specific date in the future.
Right, but modern banking and inflation-protected bonds kind of made them obsolete.
Exactly. The only reason you need to know this term for the Series 65 is for pure definition questions.
Like a multiple choice thing.
Right. If the exam asks which of the following is classified as an investment company under the 1940 Act and face amount certificate is an option, you just need to know it's technically a correct answer.
But they usually just use it as a distractor.
Right. You know? Almost always.
Okay, so let's set the dinosaur aside. The real meat of the exam is in the other two categories. Let's dive into management companies. Now, these are split into two major divisions, open-end funds and closed-end funds.
And we really need to spend time here, because the mechanical differences between these two dictate everything about how they're priced and how they're treated.
So an open-end management company, that's what basically everyone means when they say mutual fund.
Exactly. If you're looking at your 401k, you're almost certainly looking at open-end funds.
So what are the actual mechanics? The defining trait is continuous issuance and redemption, meaning there's no fixed number of shares.
Right. I always like to think of an open-end fund as a massive financial sponge. It has no fixed size at all.
Okay, a sponge. I like that.
Yeah. So if you want to invest 10 grand into a mutual fund today, the fund literally creates brand new shares out of thin air. It hands them to you and takes your 10 grand to go buy more underlying stocks.
The sponge expands.
The sponge expands. And when you want your money back,
it shrinks.
Right. You hand your shares back to the fund. The fund destroys those shares and gives you cash from the portfolio.
So you're dealing exclusively with the fund itself.
100% of the time.
Yeah.
It's always a primary market transaction.
Okay. I want you to pause and think about that for a second. If you are only ever transacting with the fund itself, what does that mean for frantic Fiona?
Oh, this is going to stress her out.
Big time. So Fiona wakes up at 11 a.m. She sees a scary news report and she wants to sell her open-end mutual fund immediately. Can she pull up her brokerage app and just dump those shares onto the New York Stock Exchange?
No, she absolutely cannot do that.
And this is exactly where the exam will try to trap you.
It's a massive red flag. Open-end fund shares never trade on a secondary exchange.
Never. You can't trade them intraday. You can't buy them from another investor on an app.
So if you see a test question that mentions a fund trading on an exchange or trading at a premium or having a bid-ask spread,
you just immediately cross out open-end mutual fund. It cannot be the answer.
They do not trade. They are issued and they are redeemed, period.
Which brings up a pretty big question. If they don't trade on an exchange, how do we actually know what they're worth? How are they priced?
They use net asset value, or NAV.
Okay, and the formula for NAV is fairly straightforward, right?
Conceptually, yes.
Yeah.
You take all the assets in the fund's portfolio, subtract any liabilities or fees they owe, and divide that by the total number of outstanding shares.
That gives you the NAV per share, but here is the part that always frustrated me as a consumer. Why is the NAV only calculated once a day?
It does seem slow, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like, we have algorithmic trading, we have fiber optics. I know exactly what a share of Apple is worth at 1.14 p.m. in 36 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So why do mutual funds make us wait until the 4.0 p.m. Eastern closing bell?
It really comes down to the sheer complexity of the portfolio and the SEC's mandate for fairness.
How so?
Well, a large mutual fund might hold 2,000 different stocks and bonds. And throughout the trading day, the prices of those 2,000 assets are constantly jumping around.
Right.
If the fund tried to calculate NAV continuously all day, you would be a total nightmare of moving targets. and sophisticated institutional traders could exploit those tiny microsecond pricing lags.
Ah, so it's basically a defense mechanism against arbitrage.
Exactly. The SEC requires funds to essentially freeze time. When the New York Stock Exchange bell rings at 4:00 p.m. Eastern, the markets stop.
Okay.
Then the fund accountants take a snapshot of the closing price of every single asset in that massive portfolio. They do the huge calculation, and usually around 5:30 or 6:00 p.m., they publish the official NAV for that day.
Okay, and this specific mechanism creates the rule of forward pricing. And listener, you need to know forward pricing. It is heavily tested.
Heavily tested. Forward pricing basically dictates that whenever you place an order for a mutual fund, you will always receive the next available calculated NAV.
You never look backward.
Never.
So let's put frantic Fiona through this. Fiona logs into her account at 3:59 p.m. Eastern. She hits buy on an open-end mutual fund. She doesn't know the exact price yet, but what price is she legally entitled to?
She gets that day's price. Because her order was received before the 4:00 p.m. cutoff, it will execute at the NAV that gets calculated a couple hours later.
Based on that day's closing prices. But what if she hesitated? What if Fiona hits buy at 4:01 p.m.? She's literally 1 minute late.
Then she just bought a ticket for tomorrow's train.
Oh, man, she hates that.
She is locked in to receive the NAV that will be calculated at 4:00 p.m. the following business day.
So if the market crashes by 5% tomorrow, she's still buying.
She's still buying. She'll get it at tomorrow's depressed price, but she is essentially flying blind for 24 hours.
Fiona despises forward pricing. She hates losing that control. But as you said, regulators mandate it. Now, when we talk about buying and selling these funds, there's specific vocabulary you have to know for the exam.
Yes. When you sell or redeem your shares back to the fund, the law states you must receive the NAV, the net asset value.
But when you buy into the fund, you don't necessarily just pay the NAV, right?
Correct. You pay the public offering price or the POP.
The POP, what exactly is that?
The POP is simply the NAV plus any applicable sales charge, which is often called a front-end load.
That's how the broker gets paid.
Exactly. So the formula to write down is NAV plus sales charge equals POP.
And if it's a no-load fund,
then the sales charge is zero, which means the NAV just equals the POP.
Got it. Now, what about liquidity? Because if Fiona hits sell, how long can the mutual fund legally hold on to her money? Because the manager might have to go sell millions of dollars of stock to raise her cash.
The 1940 Act drew a very hard line in the sand here. The fund must send the investor their redemption proceeds within 7 calendar days.
Okay, I want to flag that detail. 7 calendar days, not business days.
Yes, if you see business days on the exam, it's a trick. It is a distractor.
Right, and because open-end funds are considered a continuous primary offering, the rules on how you can trade them are super strict. You cannot buy a mutual fund on margin.
No, you can't borrow money from your broker to buy more shares.
And you cannot sell them short.
Right, you can't bet against an open-end fund. The sponge only works in one direction, cash in or cash out. No speculative margin borrowing allowed.
Okay, which brings us perfectly to the counterstructure. Because if you're a portfolio manager, open-end funds sound incredibly stressful.
Oh, they can be.
What if you're trying to run a really delicate strategy, like buying distressed municipal bonds that are super hard to sell quickly?
If you're that manager, frantic Fiona is your absolute worst nightmare.
Totally. Because you carefully build this portfolio, and then Fiona and 1,000 other retail investors get spooked by the news and hit redeem.
Right. And under that 7-day rule, you're suddenly forced to liquidate your carefully chosen bonds at fire sale prices just to raise cash for Fiona.
It ruins the portfolio for everyone else who stayed in the fund.
It does. The manager is basically held hostage by daily inflows and outflows. They actually have to hold a large chunk of the fund in uninvested cash just to prepare for redemptions.
Which causes cash drag and hurts returns.
Exactly. So how does a manager build a fund where they never have to deal with retail redemptions?
They create the second type of management company, the closed-end fund.
Yes. The closed-end structure completely solves the liquidity nightmare for the manager.
I have an analogy for this to contrast them side by side.
Let's hear it.
So think of an open-end fund like a restaurant kitchen that takes continuous orders. 5 people walk in, the chef bakes 5 pizzas. 100 people walk in, the chef bakes 100 pizzas.
The kitchen is constantly buying more flour and cheese, expanding and shrinking the dough supply based on who is standing at the register.
Exactly. But a closed-end fund is a completely different business model. A closed-end fund is a chef who decides to bake one giant, massive pizza on January 1st.
One time.
Let's say it has exactly 1 million slices. They hold an initial public offering, an IPO. They sell those 1 million slices to the public to raise their capital. And once every single slice is sold,
the chef locks the kitchen doors.
They lock the doors. They are done. The fund now has a fixed, static number of shares outstanding.
So if you missed the IPO in January, and now it's June, and you really want a slice of that pizza, you can't go to the kitchen.
No, the chef won't bake a new slice for you.
So what do you do?
You have to go out into the dining room, which is the secondary market, the stock exchange, and you have to find a customer who already owns a slice. You have to convince them to sell it to you.
And that structural difference changes absolutely everything about how the fund is priced.
Right, because you're buying and selling these fixed shares on a stock exchange like the NYSE.
Which means the price is determined entirely by secondary market supply and demand, not strictly by the underlying net asset value.
The chef can still look at the ingredients and say, mathematically, the flour and cheese on this slice are worth exactly $10.
But the market might completely disagree. If the manager is famous and the strategy is doing great, everyone in the dining room might be starving for that specific pizza.
Right.
So you might have to pay the current shareholder $12 to convince them to part with a slice that technically only has $10 worth of ingredients.
And in that scenario, the closed-end fund is trading at a premium to its NAV.
But conversely, and this is actually much more common, maybe the fund is underperforming. Or maybe investors are just scared of the broader market.
The guy holding the slice is just desperate to get rid of it.
Yeah. So he sells it to you for $8, even though the NAV is $10.
In that scenario, the fund is trading at a discount to its NAV. And listener, if you are taking notes, listen very closely to this dynamic. This is one of the highest yield concepts on the exam.
It really is. Closed-end funds commonly trade at a discount to their NAV.
Right. So if a test question says an investment company has a net asset value of $20 a share, but is currently trading on the market at $18.50, your brain has to immediately scream closed-end fund.
It's the only logical answer. An open-end fund can never trade below its NAV because the fund guarantees to redeem your shares exactly at NAV every single day.
Only a closed-end fund, which is subject to the brutal forces of supply and demand, can detach from its NAV and trade at a discount.
And the beauty of this for the portfolio manager is total stability.
Oh, yeah. If Fiona panics and wants to sell her closed-end fund shares, she doesn't bother the manager at all.
The manager doesn't have to sell a single bond. Fiona just goes to the stock exchange and dumps her shares onto the market.
It drives the market price down for other investors, but the manager's capital pool is completely untouched.
And because of that stability, closed-end funds are legally permitted to do things that open-end funds just cannot do.
Like what?
Well, they can invest heavily in highly illiquid assets. And very importantly for the exam, closed-end funds are allowed to issue senior securities.
Meaning they can use leverage.
Yes. They can issue preferred stock or issue bonds to borrow money, which magnifies their returns. Open-end funds can't do that.
And from the investor's perspective, because these shares trade on an exchange exactly like shares of Microsoft, the trading rules are totally different. You can buy closed-end funds on margin.
You can sell them short.
And you get intraday pricing. Fiona can buy at 10 a.m., watch the market, and sell at 11:30 a.m.
So let's just synthesize this first section on management companies real quick.
Okay, lay it out.
Open-end means continuous issuance, forward pricing at NAV, a 7-day redemption guarantee, no margin, no shorting, and never trading on an exchange.
Got it. And closed-end?
Closed-end means a one-time IPO, a fixed number of shares, intraday trading on an exchange, the ability to trade at premiums and discounts, and leverage, margin, and shorting are all permitted.
Beautifully summarized. Okay, so both of those vehicles involve active management. They have a portfolio manager charging a management fee to try and beat the market. But what about passive Pete?
Oh, Pete is rolling his eyes at this whole system.
He's like, why am I paying a manager 1% a year to probably underperform the index?
He does not want a manager actively tinkering with his money.
So this brings us to the next major area. What happens when you strip the manager entirely out of the equation? We're looking at the alternative structures. Unit investment trusts, or UITs, and exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. Let's start with Pete's ideal structure, the UIT.
So a unit investment trust is the third statutory classification under the 1940 Act, right alongside management companies and those extinct face amount certificates.
And the mechanics are totally distinct. A UIT is essentially a fixed static portfolio.
Right. So the sponsor of the UIT will assemble a massive basket of securities. Historically, this is very often a portfolio of municipal bonds.
And once that basket is built, they basically lock the bolt.
There is no board of directors. There is no investment advisor. There's only a trustee, usually a bank, that handles the paperwork and distributes the interest payments.
And because there's no advisor making buy or sell decisions, there is no active management fee.
Pete loves this. He pays an upfront creation charge and a tiny fractional fee to the trustee, but he's not bleeding out a 1% fee every year.
But the trade-off is total inflexibility, right? Like if one of those bonds starts getting downgraded by credit agencies, and it's definitely going to default.
The trustee doesn't do anything. They do not sell the bad bond to buy a better one. The portfolio is unmanaged. It just sits there.
So why on earth would Pete want a fund that can't react to bad news?
Predictability. Pete knows exactly what he owns on day one, and he knows exactly what the yield will be if he holds it to maturity. Plus, UITs have a specific stated termination date.
Ah, that is crucial.
Yes. When the trust is created, it comes with an expiration date. Usually that aligns with the maturity dates of the underlying bonds.
So when that date hits, the bonds mature, the trust gets the principal back, the cash is distributed to the investors, and the trust just dissolves.
Exactly. And this is a major area for exam traps. The test will give you a bulleted list of characteristics and ask you to identify the vehicle.
So what are the keywords?
If you see the phrases not actively managed, no management fee, fixed basket, or stated termination date, you must immediately identify it as a UIT. Do not confuse it with a mutual fund.
Right. And much like an open-end mutual fund, a UIT issues redeemable units. They do not trade on a secondary exchange.
So if Pete needs his money before the termination date, he has to go back to the trust and redeem his units directly at their NAV.
Okay, so that is the UIT. It's quiet, it's static, it's a sleepy basket of bonds waiting to mature. But now, wait, stop right there. If you're checking your email, come back to me. We are about to enter the most fascinating, bizarre, and heavily tested area of modern finance.
We are talking about the hybrid beast.
The exchange-traded fund, the ETF.
The ETF is arguably the greatest financial innovation of the last 40 years. But legally, it's the weirdest loophole on your exam.
Let's talk about the legal structure versus the reality of how they actually behave.
Legally, under the Investment Company Act of 1940, ETFs do not have their own special category. The law was written in 1940, right, long before anyone conceived of an ETF. The SPY didn't launch until 1993.
Right, so to legally exist under the old law, an ETF has to structure itself as either an open-end fund or a UIT.
But wait, we just spent 20 minutes explaining that open-end funds and UITs do not trade on exchanges.
That is the paradox. But the creators of the ETF went to the SEC and applied for exemptive relief.
Right. They basically said, we want to build a fund that is structurally an open-end fund, capable of continuous creation and redemption, but we want permission to list our shares on a public stock exchange.
So regular retail investors can trade them all day long.
And after years of debate, the SEC finally said yes.
So ETFs are legally open-end funds, but they trade on exchanges like stocks. They trade exactly like closed-end funds.
They are the ultimate hybrid, continuous creation grafted onto intraday exchange trading.
So let's bring frantic Fiona back. If ETFs trade all day on an exchange, what kind of pricing does she get? Does she have to wait for the 4-point EURPM forward pricing like a mutual fund?
Think about the mechanics. It's on an exchange, therefore she gets continuous intraday pricing.
Nice. She can buy an ETF at 10:15 a.m., see it go up, and sell it at 11:30. She can sell it short, she can buy it on margin. Fiona is totally in her element.
But this creates a massive structural problem. We just established that if a fund trades on an exchange based on supply and demand, like a closed-end fund, the market price can drift far away from its NAV.
Right. If the ETF holds exactly $500 worth of S&P 500 stocks per share, but suddenly retail investors panic and hit sell, couldn't the ETF market price drop to $450?
In theory, yes. But in the real world, ETF market prices almost perfectly track their NAV. They almost never trade at significant persistent premiums or discounts.
So how does an ETF defy the laws of supply and demand?
To understand why, you have to look behind the curtain at the true genius of the ETF structure. You have to understand the AP, the authorized participant.
This is one of our most brilliant mechanisms in finance. And the exam will test you on how this arbitrage works. Let's use an analogy to break down the in-kind creation and redemption process.
Okay, so let's walk through it step by step.
Imagine the ETF is a massive, heavily guarded vault. and its goal is to perfectly track the price of real, physical apples. The ETF issues Apple certificates, and those certificates are traded by everyday people on the stock exchange.
And the physical apples represent the underlying portfolio, the NAV.
Right. Now, enter the AP, the authorized participant. This is not Frantic Fiona. This is a massive institutional market maker. Think of them as a giant grocery chain logistics company.
Okay.
The ETF sponsor signs a special legal contract with the AP that says, listen, anytime you want, you can drive a truck up to our vault, hand us a physical basket of apples, and we will hand you a brand new Apple certificate.
And conversely, you can bring us an Apple certificate, we will destroy it, and we will hand you the physical basket of apples.
This is the crux of the ETF. They are swapping the underlying assets for the ETF shares. This is an in-kind transaction.
It is absolutely vital to note that no cash changes hands in this vault exchange. It is a pure barter system, securities for shares.
So how does this barter system keep the price on the stock exchange tethered to the NAV of the apples? It's AP arbitrage.
Arbitrage is just securing a risk-free profit by exploiting a temporary price discrepancy. Let's look at how the AP exploits a premium.
Let's say a health craze hits the country. Everyone wants Apple certificates. Fiona and millions of others bid the price of the certificate up to $105 on the exchange.
But the actual physical apples at the wholesale grocery store are still only worth $100. The ETF is now trading at a $5 premium.
The AP sees this and they immediately execute a four-step creation process. Step one, the AP goes to the open wholesale market and buys $100 worth of physical apples.
Step two, the AP backs their truck up to the ETF vault, delivers the apples, and demands a certificate.
Step three, the ETF vault takes the apples, creates a brand new certificate out of thin air, and hands it to the AP.
Step four, the AP immediately turns around, walks onto the public stock exchange, and sells that newly created certificate to Frantic Fiona for $105.
The AP just made a risk-free $5 profit.
But think about the macroeconomic effect. Because the AP dumped a new certificate onto the exchange, the supply of certificates increased.
And when supply increases, price falls. The AP's actions literally drive the price of the certificate back down from 105 to exactly 100, perfectly matching the NAV.
It is entirely self-correcting, and it works in the exact opposite direction if the ETF falls to a discount.
Right. Say there's a panic. The certificate on the exchange drops to $95, but the physical apples are still worth 100.
The AP steps in. Step one, they buy the discounted certificates on the exchange for 95.
Step two, they drive them to the vault.
Step three, the ETF cancels the certificates and hands the AP the physical basket of apples.
Step four, the AP sells those physical apples on the open wholesale market for 100, another $5 risk-free profit.
And by buying up those cheap certificates, the AP reduced the circulating supply on the exchange, driving the price back up from 95 to 100.
This constant arbitrage is an invisible tether. But let's flag the exam traps here, because test writers get really sneaky about this.
The first major trap revolves around cash. ETF creation and redemption is in kind. It is a swap of securities for shares. It is not a cash transaction.
If an exam question implies the fund is handing out cash for redemptions, it's describing a mutual fund, not an ETF's primary market.
The second trap is about access. Retail investors like Fiona and Pete cannot create or redeem shares directly with the ETF vault.
Never. Only the authorized participants have the key to the vault. Fiona just buys on the secondary market.
Now let's bring in billionaire Barry. Barry has tens of millions. Why does he heavily prefer ETFs over traditional mutual funds?
It's his favorite subject. Taxes.
Yes. Mutual funds have a nasty structural flaw with capital gains.
To understand it, think about the mutual fund's cash redemption rule. If thousands of investors panic and redeem in November, the manager has to give them cash.
To raise that cash, the manager is forced to sell massive blocks of underlying stocks. And if they've held those stocks for years, they probably have huge investment gains.
Which triggers a taxable capital gain.
And the brutal part is, a mutual fund is a pass-through entity. It doesn't pay the tax, it passes it to the shareholders. But it distributes those gains to all the remaining shareholders at the end of the year.
So Barry is sitting on his yacht. He hasn't sold a single share all year. He's a patient investor. And in December, he gets a massive tax bill simply because Frantic Fiona panicked.
Barry is furious. He's paying taxes generated by other people's behavior. But an ETF solves this beautifully, thanks to Section 852 of the tax code and that in-kind redemption process.
Walk us through why it's tax-free.
When an AP redeems ETF shares, the ETF vault doesn't sell any stocks to raise cash. They just gather up a basket of physical stocks and hand them to the AP.
Because the ETF didn't sell the stocks, no taxable event occurred at the fund level.
It's brilliant. The ETF flushes out its low-cost basis stocks by handing them to APs during redemptions, completely avoiding capital gains realization.
Barry can hold his ETF for a decade and almost never get a surprise capital gains distribution.
Okay, let's lock this section in. Rapid side-by-side comparison. Mutual funds versus ETFs.
Let's run it. Trading.
ETFs trade continuously intraday on a secondary exchange. Mutual funds rely on end-of-day forward pricing at NAV and do not trade on exchanges.
Minimum investment.
An ETF minimum is just the market price of one single share. Mutual funds often have mandatory $1,000 or $3,000 minimums.
Tax efficiency.
ETFs are highly tax efficient due to the in-kind AP mechanism. Mutual funds are much lower efficiency due to cash redemption.
Expenses.
ETFs generally have lower expense ratios, though actively managed ETFs are growing rapidly.
Margin and short selling.
Permitted for ETFs. Completely prohibited for mutual funds.
Perfectly laid out. So everything we've covered so far exists under the heavy umbrella of the Investment Company Act of 1940. It's designed to protect retail investors like Fiona and Pete. But what happens when you cross the velvet rope?
You enter the private fund space.
Billionaire Barry doesn't want consumer protection. He sees mutual funds and ETFs as handcuffs. He wants unregulated leverage. He wants totally illiquid private companies. How does he legally escape the ICA rules?
He invests in private funds that explicitly rely on exemptions written into the act. These funds do not register with the SEC. They don't have daily transparency. 0 7-day liquidity rules.
But the SEC doesn't just let anyone run an unregulated fund. What's the philosophical rationale here?
The government says, if you are wealthy enough to absorb a catastrophic financial loss without ending up a ward of the state, and you have the resources to hire lawyers for due diligence, you don't need the government holding your hand.
They allow capital formation among the financial elite. To achieve this, private funds rely on one of two very specific statutory exemptions. Let's break them down.
The first is Section 3C1, the Small Investor Private Fund Exemption. This rule states a fund doesn't have to register if it has a maximum of 100 beneficial owners and makes no public offering.
So no billboards and a hard cap of 100 people. Tiny, exclusive club. Now, there is one specific carve-out to that 100-person limit, right?
Yes. Qualifying venture capital funds can stretch that to 200 by 50 investors, but only if the fund is under $12 million in aggregate capital. But for the exam, associate the small investor exemption with a maximum of 100 investors.
Okay, what is the second exemption?
Section 3C7, the Qualified Purchaser Private Fund Exemption. Under this rule, there is no limit on the number of investors.
1,000 investors if they want.
Exactly. Every single investor in the fund must meet an extremely high financial bar. Every investor must be a qualified purchaser.
All right, pause. We are entering one of the most notorious trap zones on the Series 65. We have two terms that sound similar but are vastly different. Accredited investor versus qualified purchaser.
Do not mix these two up. The exam writers will test the exact dollar thresholds.
Let's start with accredited investor. What is the standard?
The easiest way to remember this is the 1-2-3 rule. One stands for $1 million in net worth, individually or jointly. But the caveat is that calculation must exclude the value of your primary residence.
Okay, what's the two?
Two stands for $200,000 in individual annual income for the last 2 years, with a reasonable expectation of hitting it again this year.
And the three?
Three stands for $300,000 in joint annual income with a spouse for the last 2 years.
So 1 million net worth excluding the house, or our 200K individual income, our 300K joint income, you only need to hit one to be accredited. And there's a cool trivia fact here.
The SEC recently updated the rules to include professional knowledge. If you hold a Series 7, a Series 82, or a Series 65 license in good standing, you are automatically an accredited investor.
So pass this exam and you officially punch your ticket to the accredited club. Okay, that's the accredited standard. What about the qualified purchaser standard?
It is a much higher hurdle. To be a qualified purchaser as an individual, you must have $5 million in investments, not net worth, investment.
And for entities?
If you're an entity like a family office, the threshold jumps to $25 million in investments.
Notice the distinction. Accredited looks at net worth. Qualified purchaser looks at investments. Let's test this with a scenario.
Let's run billionaire Barry through the ringer.
Barry has a $6 million mega mansion. He has a $2 million stock brokerage account, and he has a $1 million yacht. Total net worth is $9 million. Is Barry a qualified purchaser?
Think about the definitions.
The answer is N-O.
Break down why.
To be a qualified purchaser, he needs $5 million strictly in investments. His $6 million mansion is his primary residence, so that doesn't count as an investment. His $1 million yacht is a personal asset.
So his only qualifying asset is the $2 million brokerage account, which is less than $5 million. Despite a $9 million net worth, Barry is not a qualified purchaser.
But is he accredited?
Yes. His net worth, excluding his primary residence, is $3 million. That's over the $1 million threshold required by the 1-2-3 rule.
So Barry can invest in a 3C1 small investor fund, but he is barred from entering a 3C7 qualified purchaser fund.
Exactly. The velvet rope remains closed for those elite funds. Now let's look at the three flavors of private funds: hedge funds, private equity, and venture capital.
Hedge funds are the ones making massive macro bets, right?
Primarily in public market securities, stocks, bonds, currencies. But because they're exempt, they use hyper-aggressive strategies. Heavy leverage, complex derivatives, and aggressive short selling.
The classic long-short equity model.
Right. And structurally, they're typically limited partnerships. The fund manager is the general partner making decisions, and investors like Barry are the limited partners providing capital.
But the fees. Passive Pete would have a stroke.
Historically, hedge funds use the 2-and-20 fee structure. The general partner charges a 2% flat management fee on total assets every year. PLS, they take a 20% performance fee on the profits.
If they make $10 million in profit, the manager keeps $2 million. But what about liquidity? Can Barry trade it daily?
Absolutely not. Private funds impose severe liquidity restrictions, like lockup periods. Barry's money might be legally locked up for 1, 2, or 3 years.
Why do they do that?
Think about it. If a manager has heavily shorted a stock and a short squeeze happens, they are very vulnerable. If investors panicked and demanded cash, the manager would have to close out those shorts at catastrophic losses.
It would blow up the fund. The lockup prevents bank runs.
Even after the lockup expires, redemptions are usually restricted to specific windows, like quarterly, and require 30 to 90 days notice.
Okay, so that's hedge funds. What is private equity or PE?
PE funds invest directly into private, non-public companies. They might buy a struggling public company, take it private, restructure it, and sell it 5 years later.
And the timeline and capital mechanics are totally different.
A typical PE fund has a life cycle of 7 to 10 years. And Barry doesn't just write a check for his whole commitment on day one.
How does the funding work?
Through capital calls. The managers spend years hunting for companies. When they find a target, they issue a capital call. Barry, wire us $2 million of your $10 million commitment.
The capital is drawn down slowly, highly illiquid. And the third flavor is venture capital, or VC.
VC focuses exclusively on early stage and startup companies, funding engineers in a garage with zero revenue.
Highest risk, highest potential return.
The timeline is often 10 to 12 years. Most portfolio companies will go to zero. The fund relies on the power law, meaning one or two massive winners pay for the 20 bankruptcies.
Okay, let's rapid fire compare them.
Liquid public markets, long short strategies, 2-and-20 fees, lockups.
Established companies, buyouts, capital calls, 7 to 10 year life.
Early stage startups, extreme risk, 10 plus year life, power law returns.
And they're all exempt from the ICA, available only to accredited or qualified purchasers.
Okay, we are leaving the high finance velvet rope. We're returning to the tangible world. Mm-hmm. Real estate. What if Passive Cheat wants to own a Manhattan skyscraper, but he only has $1,000?
He can buy a share of a REIT, a real estate investment trust.
First question. Are REITs registered under the Investment Company Act?
No. Emphatic no. REITs are specifically exempt from the ICA.
So who regulates them?
The IRS. REITs are a creation of the tax code. Congress wanted regular people to invest in real estate without facing corporate double taxation.
Normally, a corporation pays tax on its profit, and then the shareholder pays personal tax on the dividend. Double tax.
But Congress said, if you structure as a REIT and follow strict rules, we'll grant you pass-through taxation. The REIT pays zero corporate tax, and the income passes straight to shareholders.
But the IRS makes you work for it. You have to follow the sacred rules of pass-through taxation. Grab a pen. The formula is 75-75-90 plus 95. Rule 1, 75% asset test.
At least 75% of the entity's total assets must be invested in real estate, cash, or U.S. government securities.
Rule 2, the 75% income test.
At least 75% of the gross income must come strictly from real estate sources, like rent or mortgages.
Rule 3, and this gets mixed up a lot, the 95% passive test.
At least 95% of gross income must come from passive sources. This includes the rent plus standard dividends interest. Basically, a REIT cannot be running an active operational business.
They can own the hotel building, but they can't actively run the hotel's daily management.
Exactly.
Okay, the 75 and 95 tests dictate where the money comes from. Now, the final most test number, the 90% distribution rule, this is where the money goes.
To avoid corporate tax, a REIT must distribute at least 90% of its taxable income to shareholders every year as a dividend.
Neon red flag here. Do not swap the 95 and the 90 on the test. 95 is where the money comes from. 90 is where it goes. If the exam asks what percentage of taxable income a REIT must distribute, the answer is 90%.
And it is 90% of taxable income, not gross income.
Are there ownership rules?
Yes. A REIT must have a minimum of 100 shareholders. And the 550 rule, no more than 50% of the shares can be owned by five or fewer individuals. Barry can't hoard it all.
Now, if they follow the rules, the REIT pays zero corporate tax. It passes to Pete as a dividend. But how is it taxed for Pete?
This is sneaky. Many assume it gets the lower qualified dividend rate.
But that's incorrect.
Right. Because the REIT didn't pay corporate tax, the IRS wants their full cut. REIT dividends are generally taxed as ordinary income at the investor's top marginal bracket.
Massive distinction. Taxed as ordinary income. Finally, let's talk about actually buying a REIT. We have traded versus non-traded REITs. Fiona wants real estate, but she needs instant liquidity. What do you recommend?
An exchange-traded REIT. They trade on the NYSE like Apple stock. Highly liquid, transparent pricing all day.
What if a broker puts Fiona in a non-traded REIT?
Absolute suitability disaster. Non-traded REITs are registered, but they do not trade on a public exchange. If Fiona wants her money, she can't just click sell. She has to rely on internal share repurchase programs.
Which are terrible. They might execute once a quarter or be suspended entirely.
Extremely illiquid. Poor pricing transparency based on stale appraisals. And the upfront fees can eat up 10% to 15% of the principal.
Never put a liquidity-needing client in a non-traded REIT. Strictly for sophisticated long-term investors. Traded equals liquid. Non-traded equals illiquid.
Exactly.
Incredible. We've covered the map today. Let's do a high-energy, rapid-fire rundown of the absolute top testable takeaways. You ready?
I'm ready.
Open-end mutual funds.
Continuous issuance, forward pricing calculated once daily at 4 p.m. NAV. Strict 7-calendar-day redemption rule. No margin, no shorting, never trades on an exchange.
Closed-end funds.
Fixed shares via IPO, trades intraday on an exchange, can trade at a premium or discount to NAV, margin, shorting, and leverage are permitted.
UITs.
Fixed basket, supervised by a trustee, NO active management, no management fees, stated termination date.
ETFs.
Legally open-end or UIT, but trades intraday like stocks. Highly tax-efficient due to in-kind mechanism. AP arbitrage keeps price tethered to NAV.
Private fund.
Exempt from the 1940 Act. Hedge funds use 2 and 20 fees and lockups. PE funds use capital calls over a 7-10-year life. VC targets early-stage startups.
Accredited versus qualified purchaser.
Accredited is the 1-2-3 rule. 1 million net worth, excluding primary residence, or 200K individual 300K joint income. Qualified purchaser requires a massive 5 million in pure investments.
Rates.
75% assets in real estate, 75% gross income from real estate, 95% passive income, must distribute 90% of taxable income. Dividends are ordinary income. Traded are liquid, non-traded are illiquid.
Nailed it. If you understand the why behind those points, you have secured the pooled investment section of the exam.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought. We spent a lot of time on the strict categories of the 1940 Act, but think about the evolution of the ETF. It started as a way to passively track an index, but today the industry is packing highly complex, actively managed strategies into that tax-efficient ETF wrapper. As the lines blur between traditional active mutual funds and these hybrid ETFs, how long until the SEC is forced to rewrite the Investment Company Act entirely? Keep an eye on that as you build your career.
Brilliant point. The landscape is always shifting, but the underlying mechanics, the why, remains the same. If you understand why the AP executes arbitrage or why the IRS demands a 90% distribution, you won't get tricked. You've got this. Keep studying, keep pushing, and we will see you on the next deep dive.